Welcome to Leading the Shift, a podcast from Microsoft Azure, where we hear from the people at the forefront of data, AI, and cloud technologies. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger. How many times have you been in a conversation where two people say the exact same thing at the exact same time? There is a non-zero chance that someone is going to pop out with, "Great minds think alike." Apparently, we have been using and misusing this phrase for around 400 years. I'll spare you the details, except to say it is long past time to retire this cliche. Great minds absolutely do not think alike. In fact, thinking differently is the source of some of humanity's greatest achievements. Today, we're going to talk about the innovation potential in neurodiversity. If you're new to the term, neurodiversity is the idea that people experience and interact with the world in many different ways, and there is no quote-unquote right way for the brain to function. It's most often used in the context of autism, ADHD, and learning differences. But what makes neurodiversity relevant to today's conversation is that generative AI enables us to interact with technology in more natural and intuitive ways. And I do mean ways plural, because what's natural and intuitive for me might not be natural and intuitive for you. And that ability to support multiple ways of perceiving, thinking, and communicating has huge implications, both for inclusivity and innovation. Today, my guest is Hiren Shukla, who leads the Neurodiversity Center of Excellence at EY. Hiren and his team have been working closely with neurodiverse people to accelerate emerging technologies and solve complex problems. Here's a video clip featuring John Franzen, a developer at EY, and Hiren. You'll hear John's voice first.
It is estimated that 20% of the global workforce identifies neurodivergent. I'm one of them. When I'm coding, the tools that are supposed to be helping sometimes disrupt my focus.
EY is rethinking enterprise intelligence. We want to unlock the potential of every employee because we know inclusion drives innovation. We operate the Neurodiverse Centers of Excellence globally to promote the business value of an inclusive workforce.
Hiren, it's so great to have you here. Welcome to Leading the Shift.
Excited to be here, Susan. Thanks for inviting me.
No, it's great. It's great. I mean, neurodiversity is a topic that I am really, really passionate about. And so it's such a delight to be able to sit down and have this conversation with you. I would love to just start with a little bit about you and sort of where you are now, what brought you to this role, and kind of how you think about it, and then we'll go from there.
I really came to this, if I'm honest, by accident, but I think there's some fate involved. So effectively, I'm thinking about 10 years ago, innovation, and how do you create new value in the world? How do you accelerate the data and technology uses? Because it's so powerful. It's not about solving a problem. It's actually looking for problems to solve. And in that journey, I stumbled into conversations around this concept of neurodiversity, which is this dimension of cognitive variance in the world. And Susan, I was both fascinated and disturbed at the same time. How is it I've gone all my life with blinders on, never understanding or knowing that this beautiful variety and dimension of thinking differently is literally amongst us, under our noses? And why is it that in many cases we fail to include that transformative power of thinking differently in how we innovate? And so that's really what brought me here, along with, if I'm honest, a bit of crisis of purpose in my life. What am I doing with myself? And how do I achieve more in my life than just going to work every day?
Yeah. And so how long has the Center of Excellence, the Neurodiversity Center of Excellence, existed at EY? When was it founded?
It was conceived 10 years ago, and we formally launched on March 7th, 2016 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So we're going to celebrate our 9-year anniversary next month.
That's amazing. And what was the sort of precipitating event? Was there one, or sort of what made it come to happen, come to pass?
I think what made the Neurodiverse Centers of Excellence come to life was this intersection of this business purpose around skills. Where do we find differentiated, accelerating skills around data and technology? And how do we unlock that power of thinking differently to create innovation possibilities? And it was that, I think, combined with a bit of sense of purpose. We are a very purpose-based organization. And for me, I think my purpose was telling that story and proving something that, frankly, nobody else had proven to date, that the power of being different makes us so much better. I think, which is what we all know and accept as gravity, but seeing it tangibly was a bit of a personal thing for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in everyday life, people talk about things that are strengths for them or things that they have difficulty with or challenges with, things that come to them naturally, things they have to work harder at. And, you know, at the same time, there is research out there. And I think there are a few data points that suggest that between 10 and 20% of the population has some kind of neurodiverse, some kind of neurodiversity, be it ADHD or dyslexia or they're autistic or whatever it might be. And so more and more, I think people are thinking about what are these different ways that the brain can operate, and are there ways that we can kind of unlock some of that potential and actually at the same time create more comfortable ways for people who are neurodiverse to interact with us in a professional environment, because we also know that traditionally, historically, not neurodiverse people, and I'm thinking actually in this case specifically of autistic people, have had a hard time, you know, finding work and have a hard time keeping work for a bunch of reasons that have nothing to do with their potential and their capabilities, but have a lot to do with the way that we construct the world of work around them.
Absolutely. You know, a couple of things you said in there, Susan, are so powerful that I never realized. We're talking in the range of 20% of the existing workforce. So I never knew that we were talking about 1 in 5. We also got data in the last 18 months that are now showing that upwards of 53% of the Gen Z population identify as being neurodivergent, either with a direct diagnosis or as a identity that celebrates cognitive differences. And so I think the world is shifting. And as it shifts, you know, it shifts so slowly that unless you really pay attention, you miss the fact that innovation comes from the edges. It actually comes from thinking differently. And so I think today's environment, hyper-connectedness, the most complex problems, we need the power of thinking differently to try to address and solve some of these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about how the Center of Excellence operates. You know, what are the, like, give us some examples of the kinds of things that you do.
Sure. So the Center of Excellence at EY was really built around a concept that said unless we create sustainable and scalable processes and a model with individuals who can be subject matter resources in a organizational and business context. And Susan, I'm very deliberate in saying this because there is a conversation around parents and carers. There is a conversation around health, medical, and clinical discussions. But we're really focused on what do large organizations like EY and our clients do? And so we realized the Center of Excellence needs to build and create processes. I'll give you one simple idea. We deconstructed the reasons of why are many neurodivergent individuals who communicate, think, learn, and socialize differently, why are they not getting job offers? And the simple reason pointed to that the job interview process is designed for and by neurotypical individuals to try and assess someone's intelligence and acumen and fit for a role. And the simple thing that the Center of Excellence did was we pivoted to a performance-based observation process. And that change in process, combined with the knowledge that we provide our managers and our team members and coworkers on an ongoing basis, begins to create sustainability and momentum. So it begins to take a good idea and make it practically implementable. And that's really where the Center of Excellence, I think, fit a role that was not being filled before.
For sure. And it's so relatable. I mean, we've all talked to people who have said, oh, I'm a terrible interview. Like, or we've all known people who were like, really not comfortable in an interview environment, neurodiverse, neurotypical, whatever. And then they rock their jobs, you know, they do the most incredible things. And, you know, you and I have talked about this, and I have explicit permission from my son to share this, but, you know, he's 21 years old. He's autistic. He was diagnosed at, you know, before he was two. And, you know, when he entered the workforce, the interview process was really difficult for him because it is the absolute, you know, for an autistic person, or at least for this autistic person, the absolute most stressful thing you could possibly do is to put him in front of strangers who are going to ask him questions. And so he's had a lot of support through another program not related to EY that basically also sort of disaggregated the interview process and supported him through his interview process. And he's about to celebrate his second year at his job, and he loves it and is doing an incredible job there. But if you had taken him, you know, and plopped him into an interview setting all by himself with no support and no norming around his own sort of communication style, it would have been a really different situation. And so that leads me to a question about some of the work that you've done with Microsoft and with Microsoft Azure AI Foundry, because that project, I think, is a wonderful example of how you sort of optimize for one group, and in optimizing for one group, you actually optimize for everybody.
Yeah. Susan, this was such an amazing opportunity. And frankly, we have two of them. One we've done on the AI Foundry tool, and the other one is really on Copilot. So in both cases, though, looking at the user base of these, and in Copilot, it's frankly every...
It's usually Copilot. Yeah.
In the AI Foundry piece, we found that there is a large portion of technologists in the world, no surprise, that have very high data and technology acumen, aptitude. They happen to be a bit prolific around the use of technology, and they happen to be neurodivergent.
Uh-huh.
And so building these AI tools that have an inclusive consideration built into that user experience, and that is exactly what we did with the Microsoft AI Foundry team on user testing and feedback specifically from a neurodivergent point of view. And what does that feedback do to improve the usage of the tool for everyone? And I'll give you one specific area that we looked at that sounds simplistic, but I think we've all faced this. So when you're in a technology and you get notifications, could be an error notification, it could be support or help. Where those notifications show up, in what way you control the notifications and the levels, how succinct or expansive those notifications are, all of these things can interrupt the flow of a technologist in the course of their work. And one of the things that the neurodivergent technologist that EY did was using the tool and then saying, wow, you know, that notification process, or where the windows actually show up and how they show up, they came up with 15 ideas on how to improve.
Oh, wow.
Simply just the notification process. But I think it improves the user experience because you are tapping into a level of sensitivity that notices all of these small details that many people tend to try to ignore, but it does take up cognitive load. So that was one area that, Susan, we found tremendous benefit and support. And this is where Microsoft's commitment to inclusive technology really pays off, because we're building those features in to the tool that everybody will use.
For sure. And funnily enough, when COVID happened and everybody came home, my son was a junior high school, and I have never seen a change so dramatic in his academic work, because he came home and he's like, "Mom, all I have to do is listen to the lecture, and I'm not distracted by like kids chewing gum and tapping their feet and the leaves rustling and cars driving and people running in the halls and all the things," right? You think about the environment that we live in, and you know, a neurotypical brain can filter out all those sounds. Sometimes a neurodivergent brain, of course, you know, everybody's different, but sometimes people have challenges with that filtering process, and everything takes you away from your task.
Susan, I want to jump in because, you know, we learned about the other end of the neurodivergent spectrum, which was extremely high creativity, extremely high levels of facilitation and engagement. And we started to see that end of the neurodivergent spectrum where, funny you mentioned your son and during COVID, and I found this out about myself. I was diagnosed with ADHD about 2 years ago, which has explained many things of my time blindness. And you know, I would confess to my wife why I forget things, and she still wasn't buying it. But feeding off of the energy in the room, because you are being able to read the micro movements in someone's facial features. And when we went, everything went online. All of a sudden, that source of information was taken away. And so we often found the other end as well. But this also reminded us that, boy, neurodivergence is everywhere and in all shapes or forms. And I think that was an aha moment for us at EY.
You know, when we think about building apps, I love the idea that, you know, more and more, I would hope that, I don't know, in the future, you don't necessarily need a center of excellence, right? Because everybody has now internalized these principles and these ways of working. Is that a goal that you have? Do you want to put yourself out of business sometime in the future?
Susan, you've hit the nail on the head. We said from day one, we know when we will be doing a great job is when we're not needed anymore, because inclusive processes, behavior, language, environment, and technology will all be operating, whether it's across race, age, gender, sexual orientation. But at the end of the day, all of us think slightly differently. It is the neurotypical population, the majority today, that tends to try to converge. And this creates tension. It creates mental health challenges. But Susan, we already are opening the channels to the realm of cognitive intelligence, which is really what we love, is what does artificial general intelligence and many Gen AI tools try? They're trying to mimic cognitive intelligence, for which the human race already has such a great variety. And so when we tap into this, we're really applying and unlocking the power of divergence that exists in each of us.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, there have been many theories, sociological theories, about what intelligence is. And of course, that work continues. What I wonder about, though, is that, you know, in the disability community, there's a phrase, nothing about us without us.
Yes.
And I know that you have worked and co-created with neurodiverse employees at EY to get their feedback and to kind of co-create these new approaches and these new features. What does that look like? And how do you build trust?
Yeah, Susan, I love this question because it is the layered nuance between this is a good idea, how do I actually implement this in a scalable way?
Yeah.
And I love that you're touching on the concept of trust, which is how do you earn it? And what we've learned along the way, you know, when we launched our neurodiverse centers of excellence, there was many questions. Why do we need a neurodiverse center of excellence? And it was the invisible dimension in each of us, and particularly around neurodiversity, that was not explicitly acknowledged to the point to say, do you see me? Do you understand and celebrate my uniqueness? And it's not talked about. You touched upon the disabilities community. It wasn't talked about in a deficits-based manner. It was actually flipped to say, we want to include and celebrate the strengths-based approach in each of us while acknowledging and providing the support that each of us need. But Susan talking about it and actually explicitly calling this out was the first outreach to the community to say, we see you, we want to hear you, and by the way, your ideas matter because you will help shape this in what we do. And so, Susan, every time we've run projects and cohorts and product creation, it's always been with individuals who are openly neurodivergent because they're shaping and iterating upon the improvements we make here. So at the end of the day, it really becomes this cohesive connective tissue that gets layered into, as you say, business as usual. Everything we do has to be that way. And the last thing I'll say on building trust, I think it's acknowledging the challenges that have been there. We've been open from day one. We don't know everything that we're doing here. We're going to learn, but we're going to learn with each other. And at the end of the day, again, this is about how do we create value, speed, velocity, innovation for large organizations. And that, I think, was very transparent to folks to say, ah, now here and I understand why you're doing this. And you're not trying to cloak this under, you know, an altruistic, purely, I'm doing this because to help those people.
Right, right. You're not putting them in the position of being the other. You are incorporating them from the start.
Absolutely. Susan, we know that, you know, if we go with 1 in 5 in the workplace and neurodivergent, we now have seen studies that show over 70% of those individuals will not disclose in fear that this will be held against them. And so as we work with the largest organizations in the world, to say, you realize you're sitting on compressed innovation capacity. It's literally under your nose. You're already paying for this. You already have it. And they say, great, how do I unlock it? And it says, well, it goes now to your managers. It goes to your team members, because this is not about fixing or converting those that are neurodivergent to be like everybody else. In fact, that was defeat the purpose. So let's train the rest of our organization and create processes that create the safety, because then this beauty of diverse ideas start to come out.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the opportunity really lies.
For sure. So let's shift gears a little bit into, you know, what have you seen, you know, from some of the work that you've done either with Microsoft or with other organizations or just internally at EY, like how, when you are called to speak with your executives and tell them how this is going, like what metrics do you give them? How do you explain that?
This is such an important question, because I came to this not as a parent or a carer or a clinician. I came to this as a business leader who is being judged on the business value that I create at EY. Productivity, innovation, speed, customer engagement, right? These are all the things and the, you know, KPIs, OKRs, whatever other acronyms you want to use on metrics. I had to come to this in that manner. And so, Susan, we had to go back and say, we're doing all of this work around including divergent thinking to produce new product. Have we produced new product? And we started to see new product creation and then measure the economic value of that. We started to measure the client engagement.
See what we were getting.
And frankly, it was creating opportunities for new conversations and deeper, more connective tissue, if I use that term again, to our clients. And frankly, that expanded to the education sector and the government sector, the nonprofit sector. And so start to elevate brand, deepen relationships. And then it was creating these innovation avenues where new data analytics and cybersecurity and AI products were being created that we were then taking to market. So Susan and I, we were able, because we had a center of excellence, to deliberately measure this, and none of this value was being diluted under the table. And so when I go to leadership, they're expecting me to go to them with the same types of strategic business outcomes. And it stripped away any preconceived notion that, oh, Heron, this is just an altruistic, philanthropic, charitable thing that you're doing, because we found that would never be sustainable and scalable.
Right, right. And all those values, you know, time to market, productivity, innovation, new products, new services, new business models, all those things, risk mitigation, they're all C-suite priorities. Every single last one of them is a C-suite priority. And so, you know, to me, that's really the only scalable way, as you say, to be able to express this work. And I think, frankly, the only fair way, because, you know, if you're talking about compressed innovation, you have to pay that off in terms of how that innovation came to life and came to market and what impact it had. It strikes me, you know, as I think about this, that with this platform shift we're going through in this age of generative AI, when, you know, the user interfaces that we're using are more and more sort of human sounding, human looking, human like, that gives us an opportunity even to expand on multiple personalized ways for people to interact with technology over time. I mean, is that something that's on your radar?
100%. You know, we now firmly grounded in people interact in ways that are very different from each other. And I'll give you one example. We've got some team members that are primarily nonverbal. Yet their technology acumen and interacting with AI is so powerful that it exceeds any average user that's there, because they're able to interact very differently. And if we were to, you know, judge a book by its cover, we would miss this value completely. But I think this point that you're making of where are we on this journey and what do we see? Funny, we're now at the point, Susan, of teaching everybody else these strategies on divergence. And so we say it's almost unlearning that most of us get as we go through school, where we're taught to and kind of forced to converge, I dare say, but opening those channels back up, you know, that 96% delta that I mentioned in Creative Genius, is accessing that, where we think, boy, could the most complex problems, climate change, world hunger, things like, could they be locked and hidden inside the mind of a nonverbal person, or written by an individual whose spelling may not be right, but now Microsoft Copilot can fix these things for us? So I think the technology is not only helping those individuals, but it's helping to unlock their real potential.
For sure. I mean, if you think about somebody like Stephen Hawking, you know, if he hadn't had if he was born in the previous century and he hadn't had access to an assisted audio device, nobody, like, all of his work would be, you know, wouldn't be available to us. I mean, that's a tragedy.
Yeah, and this is where the work we're doing with Microsoft around Copilot, specifically facilitating user adoption and innovation journeys to the neurodivergent employee population and the disabilities employee population, is really showing two things. One, the study we did showed that generative AI in general, and Copilot specifically as we use it in this case, is being seen as an assistive technology, which we thought was fascinating.
Yeah.
People are seeing it that way. And then we saw the other end of the spectrum where our neurodivergent technologist at EY, in a 3-week span, came up with over 50 innovation ideas on how to use Copilot, and they've never used this before.
Yeah.
Now opening up these innovation channels. And I think at the end of the day, there is space at the table that has to be for that power of thinking differently for individuals with different life experience. And I think AI and generative AI helps to bridge this gap so nicely.
So I'd love to just wrap up with something that we do with every episode, which is to ask for your advice. So as you think back on what you've done, as you think about other leaders at other organizations who have, you know, technology roles, who are technology decision makers or business decision makers or developers, whether or not they themselves are neurodiverse or divergent or have, even any kind of understanding of these issues, maybe it's something new. What advice do you have?
You know, the first thing I would say is let's start more conversations and discussions around the power of divergence and thinking differently. I think how we frame this topic and educate and engage others, this is still, Susan, as you know, a very relatively new thing for a lot of people. And I think the way it's grounded today is this, it's this perception around deficit space. And I think the conversation should kind of spearhead around, hey, there's real power in thinking different. And by the way, there's people and companies that are doing this already. I think that's the conversation starter that everyone needs to have.
Absolutely. And I think that deficit-based thinking narrows the opportunity space for everybody. I think that's what I get from what you're saying, is that if we start, we're already limiting our opportunity if we start from the perspective that different people who are different and think differently and communicate differently are coming from a position of having a deficit. I have learned in my personal life and my professional life that that couldn't be more wrong. And I have many friends who, and you know, colleagues and coworkers who have also come to that realization. And I think it's something we just have to keep plugging away at. So,
yeah, I think that's absolutely it. And I'll add, once you initiate the peaking curiosity and you get, then you go back to all of the examples that show this is not hypothetical anymore. This has already been proven. And I would hope that would prompt decision makers and others to say, wow, is this another gear that we've never moved into, that a lever we've never pulled? Because frankly, we're sitting on top of this beautiful capacity today of thinking differently. That's again where innovation comes from. How do I get there? And I think the work that we've been doing and the lessons learned, even the mistakes, all of these can be informed to the journeys of others.
And maybe that one of the opportunities of the platform shift is to unlock not only the compressed innovation from the technology, but the compressed innovation from us, unlock our own potential. And I'm speaking collectively here. That to me would be, you know, and to do that in a trustworthy way and to do that with the co-creation and collaboration of the people around us and an open mind and a curious mind, like that to me, like nothing gets better than that.
And the last thing I'll say though, Susan, is, you know, the need for community and how we give people a collective sense of purpose is probably needed in the world more than ever today. Think about the beauty when we feel like together we're making the world a better place and we're leveraging minds and technology, and this is creating new value in the world. And so I think there's no better time for us to start than now.
Well, I got nothing to follow up on that. So thank you. Thank you, Aaron. This has been such a lovely conversation. I'm super grateful for the work that you're doing, delighted to hear about it, and I know our listeners will be too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow. There's such a persistent theme in these conversations about trust and co-creation. It reminds me of something Perry Hewitt said in our very first episode, that building technology is not only about the what, it's about the who and the how. And that means co-designing solutions with, rather than for, the community you're trying to serve. Heron's team gets that the typical interview process can really disadvantage people who communicate, think, learn, and socialize differently, so they designed a more inclusive process. And of course, collaborating with developers like John Franzen to make Azure AI Foundry more inclusive by reducing distractions that increase cognitive load. It's a great example of how inclusive approaches can help neurodiverse employees feel seen, do their best work, and in the process, make products better for everyone. But before we wrap up, I want to come back to this idea of compressed innovation. As Heron said, it's the potential of people who may perceive the world, think, and communicate differently. We're at a point today where generative AI, and specifically multimodality, gives us unprecedented flexibility in how we design technology solutions. So it strikes me that the key to decompressing all that innovation is partly in the tech, but it's mostly on us. Only then, as Heron said, can the beauty of diverse ideas start to come out. And that's where the opportunity really lies. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And as I'm sure you know, new podcasts live and die on engagement. So please like, comment, share, tell your friends, and let us know what you'd like to hear about. We're listening. If you'd like to learn more about how people and organizations are innovating with Microsoft Azure, visit azure.microsoft.com. The Leading the Shift podcast is a place for experts to share their insights and opinions. As students of the future of technology, Microsoft values inputs from a diverse set of voices. That said, the opinions and findings of our guests are their own, and they may not necessarily reflect Microsoft's own research or positions. Leading the Shift is a production of Microsoft Azure. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger. Our executive producers are Haley Meehan, Aaron Russell, Eric Williams, and me. Production support provided by the incredible team at Indigo Slate.